Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Greetings from the hill country of Central Texas. This is Revolution of Military Affairs, and I'm your host, Amos Fox. All right, welcome back to the Revolution and Military Affairs podcast. Today, we have somebody that really, I think, fits the bill for what this podcast is about, both in name, but also in spirit. So today we have Antoine Bousquet from the Swedish Defense University, where he's an associate professor within the Department of Politics. And he's actually written a lot of stuff, but a couple things that I want to talk about today. So the first is The Scientific Way of War, Order and Chaos on the Battlefields of Modernity. And this book originally came out quite a while ago, but it's been reissued a couple times through a couple of new editions. And if you read it today, you wouldn't think it was written more than 15 years ago. You'd think it's written today about the future of conflict. So a very forward-looking book that was published a while ago. There's also an article that he wrote, that Antoine wrote, that I find fascinating, called The Battlefield is Dead. So we're going to talk about those two things and just ideas in general about war and warfare. So with that long introduction, Antoine, thank you for taking the time to meet with us today.
Thank you. Thank you for the generous introduction and for inviting me on the podcast.
Absolutely. I guess the first thing, the idea that permeates throughout the book is systems theory and systems thinking. And that's something that I think is underrepresented in a lot of modern military thinking. We don't view things through this interconnectedness of how things operate both internally and with the external environment. So what place do you feel that idea, those two ideas, systems theory and system thinking, have within the study of armed conflict?
Mm-hmm. Well, system theory is a very broad category and encapsulates a lot of ideas. And we can retrace the origins, I think, all the way back to the 1930s and 40s, when there emerged a series of concurrent developments in a variety of fields. So you find this happening in biology, in engineering, in psychology and sociology. It's an array of thinkers and kind of problem solvers who grapple with this idea of the system. And initially we see that associated with the fields of cybernetics and general systems theory, Today more commonly with what we think of as the sciences of chaos and complexity. So that being said, what is given this diversity of in its origins, what's the key common trait to it? And that clearly is this idea of the system, which is a relatively new idea and really dates from the 20th century in a meaningful sense. So what the system tries to get at is to propose a kind of framing for understanding phenomena, for understanding entities from a holistic perspective. So really it's in opposition to more traditional reductionist understandings, where you would take a system or an entity, and you would try and understand its components by breaking it down to its constituent elements. And then once you understood the elements of it, you would build it back up, you'd reassemble it. So, you know, that would be kind of like a clockwork mechanism. If you wanted to understand how a clockwork mechanism works, you would take mm-hmm. the clock apart, you would look at all the cogs, and you would understand how all the cogs work, and then you would reassemble it. That's a kind of reductionist model of science, which prevailed throughout the early scientific period, where in order to understand bigger systems, we need to understand the lower ones, and everything is contained in the lower systems.
Yeah.
The system framing says, no, you can't just reduce, because there is something that happens in the totality of the system that is not reducible to its parts. So you have to understand the inherent dynamics, the inherent properties of the system. And you have to understand how these elements are integrated as a whole, as opposed to merely in terms of their constitutive characteristics. So when you try and break it down further, then there's a number of ways in which we can understand the key constituents of a system that gets at the various ideas that permeate systems theory. One is, you know, if you look at a system, what is its structure? In other words, what is it made of? What are its components? What are its parts? How are these organized together? Secondly, you would look at its function, and that's very important. Like, a system is something that has a number of processes, operations that constitute it as a whole, mm-hmm. and are generally directed towards some sort of goal or purpose.
Yep.
And then you would think about the interconnectivity. How do all these parts connect to one another? What are the flows of mass, energy, or information that sustain them? And finally, you would think about the boundary. How is the system distinguished, separated from its environment, and what relationship does it have with that environment? So some systems can be more or less closed or open to their environment, meaning they can have more or less flows of mass, energy, and information between them, and understanding how that boundary operates and what traverses it is key to understanding the system. There's a final kind of analytical point here about the boundary, which is very important, which is, in a sense, there's a certain arbitrariness to where you draw the boundaries of a system. You know, you can think of an organism as a system, but you can also think about a collective as a system. Or you can think, you know, so you could take a species, you know, or a herd of animals as being the system. Or you could take the environment, including the system, the herd, and all sorts of other beings as being the system. So in a sense, it's systems all the way down. Yeah. So when you conduct a systems analysis, you need to make a kind of decision early on as to what is the scale at which you're observing it. And that's very much a function of the decisions made by the observing system.
Yep.
There's that other layer as well, which is that as analysts, we are also observing systems, who therefore have their own relationships with their environment. And even to go even further, we have systems that are able to introspect, to observe themselves. Like, we as humans are very much mm-hmm. introspective systems. So the whole framing of systems gets very complex. And you need to, there's not only, in a way, system theory is a kind of, to use a kind of philosophical term, it has an ontological character, which is says something about how the world is. The world yeah. is made of systems. But it also brings with it very profound epistemological questions, which is, how do we know things? You know, how do systems know things? Because if everything is systems, we are also, of course, systems. Now, to get to your final question, you know, how does this all relate to war and the military? Well, I mean, there's an obvious kind of trite way in which it does, because if you assume everything is a system, then by definition, armed conflict is also going to be made of systems.
Yep.
But to be a little bit more specific, it seems pretty obvious that military organizations are themselves systems, very complex systems, compose themselves of systems, technical and human and social and so forth. And for a long time, the military has had some understanding of this. The disciplines of operations research and systems analysis that grew out of the Second World War really evolve next to this systems theory that I've discussed. In fact, they're at the origins of some of it. So there's a longstanding appreciation of systems, at least from this kind of more engineering managerial perspective, not necessarily so less so perhaps at the level of command or frontline. But also, of course, ultimately, war itself can be understood as a system. And in doing so, well, you know, we can hope to perhaps understand some of its dynamics better, perhaps control it, although the question of to the extent to which we control dynamic systems is an open one.
Yeah. I think that at least on the U.S. or Western side of this question, perhaps, there was a great leap, because I think that this is a very important concept, and it's applicable in war and warfare, very much so. And there was a big leap made in the 90s, with John Boyd and the enemy as a system. But then after that construct failed a little later down the road, perhaps probably because it was misapplied to some degree, there's been this this shunning of systems thinking in a lot of cases as it relates to the way the military thinks about war and warfare. And so it's just an interesting thing. And there's something you said, too, that I wanted to hit on, the framing of systems. I think that's always something that is somebody that's published several things, several papers and whatnot. Something that I always find a lot of the arguments against something you may or may have, a point you may have made when you're doing writing goes to that the person reading the thing you wrote doesn't understand the frame necessarily that you put around it or the constraints that you were operating under. And so like sometimes when I'm reading a book, like I'll find something and I'll write no in the margin, but it could just be that you don't understand the frame because, authors don't always have the time to sit down and explain every bracket and the parameters associated with that. And so that's, I think, an important thing to understand is the framing of arguments and the framing of systems is vitally important to appreciating how they operate.
Just to touch briefly on the two points you made, I think an inherent difficulty for, well, any organization, but I think it affects the military particularly, is when you try and appropriate complex ideas like the system. And, as I say, I was just scratching at the surface of it, but you can see all the big questions that arise from it. The problem with concepts like these is that they tend to be appropriated, and as they become appropriated and kind of brought down to be as accessible as possible, often they then become quite fossilized and rigid and hollowed out, and people lose the all the subtle nuances and even all the open questions that come with it, and it becomes another item of doctrine of you just speak the buzzword and then everyone follows suit. But eventually everyone uses mouth the word, but nobody really understands what it means anymore or have lost the kind of nuance that came with it originally.
Having worked on ideas and how ideas get published in a military, I can assure you that as things get pushed through the system, the nuance, something that may be very craggy and very ugly looking as it's coming through because it has so much nuance and distinction to it, gets whittled down to a very nice sphere as it comes through that process of approval. The other thing real quick, I said John Boyd, I meant John Warden when I mentioned the enemy as a system. As you were talking, I realized that I had said the wrong name. All right, so with that in mind, not the wrong name part, but the systems idea in mind, in your book you lay out four regimes of the scientific way of warfare. Why is it that this taxonomy is needed, and how do you find it useful for the study of war?
Well, I think what I propose in the book is a periodization. Is to think about the span of the modern era of war, so going back to the 17th and 18th centuries up to present day, and to think about the period during which the modern kind of science took form and became increasingly influential broadly culturally, but specifically in this case, on the way in which war was imagined and practiced. And in doing so, I came up with a kind of these four categories, which follow, I would say, main periods in the scientific ideas that dominated the periods, and see how we can think of them as correlated to the practice of war. So these four periods are centered around four bodies of scientific theory, but also four technologies. So the technology is the clock, the engine, the computer, and the network. And they're all key technologies because they, of course, have material qualities. You see these technologies everywhere in their contemporary periods, but also they're metaphors, they're models for the way in which the world is. Mm-hmm. So the clockwork kind of maps onto Newtonian's idea of a clockwork universe. It's incredibly stable and regular and can be understood in the reductionist way that I outlined earlier. You have the engine, of course, that powers the Industrial Revolution. You have the computer that becomes, you know, central to economic and political activity throughout the 20th century. And the network, of course, we all live in the age of the network. We're used to thinking of that. And of course, the computer becomes, the engine becomes a model for the human body. We're all kind of producing energy and processing energy, and the computer becomes a model for the brain and for the way in which we process information, and the network, as I say, becomes a model for society and technology. Now, next to these technologies are then kind of bodies of scientific thinking: mechanism with the clockwork, thermodynamics with the engine, cybernetics with the computer, and chaos theory and complexity, which I called chaoplexity, mm-hmm. associated with the network. So trying to keep this brief and not in too much detail, what happens in these periods is that you get different kinds of military approaches that echo these scientific and technological paradigms. So mechanistic warfare or mechanistic armies, which we think of as predominating in the 18th century, think of the Prussian army of Frederick the Great, are incredibly well-drilled soldiers performing rehearsed moves on the battlefield, very little autonomy, but a way of maintaining order on the battlefield in accordance with the instructions of a single commander. So highly centralized, effective, but, you know, with no ability to adapt to what's going on the battlefield. That gives way to kind of a thermodynamic era where war becomes a more dynamic activity. Energy becomes central to the conduct of war, whether it's the popular energies, you know, think of the levée en masse of the French revolutionary armies or the mobilization of the world wars, or it's the energy that's introduced through the industrialization of war, the motorization of vehicles, of course, on land, on air, at sea, or the use of industry to produce weapons and to support very, very long, very extensive conflicts, the total wars of the 20th century. Eventually, this kind of culminates, we could say, in a sense, with the Second World War and the atomic weapon, the kind of paroxysm of energy being channeled into war. But it also at that point kind of pivots into a new model, a cybernetic model, where increasingly computers and information become central to the conduct of war. And here, of course, we would think of the computerization of the military during the Cold War, the building of modeling systems, of all sorts of scientific approaches to the exercise of war. Huge command and control infrastructures have to be erected, particularly in preparation for a potential nuclear war. So many things have to start or become automated, obey kind of systems of cybernetic feedback. And this approach kind of encounters a bit of a crisis in Vietnam, where the US, despite on paper having a far more advanced military, having all this sophisticated computer technology, is unable to decisively defeat the North Vietnamese. And at the same time, the science is kind of moving away from some of the early postulates of cybernetics. We're operating still in a regime where information is the key scientific concept, but increasingly we're interested in systems that have emergent properties, self-adaptation, decentralized bottom-up emergence that you might associate with the dynamics of swarms in the animal world, other kind of dynamic nonlinear processes such as the weather and so forth. And from the late 70s onwards, we start seeing these ideas beginning to percolate into the military, notably through this understanding of the network, a criticism or critique of the Vietnam War and of what's perceived as a highly centralized Cold War military, which then gives rise to, in the 1990s, the ideas of network-centric warfare that quite explicitly adopts these ideas from chaoplexity by saying that militaries are self-organizing systems, need to decentralize, et cetera, et cetera. The kind of application of these ideas is, I guess, pretty checkered as well, given the history of the war on terror, where, again, you know, the U.S. encounters major problems fighting much more technologically inferior adversaries. But still today, I would say these are the ideas that predominate within the military. That is to say, we're still kind of reinventing this wheel of we need networks, we need to decentralize, we need adaptation. There's a new wind, I think, that's been brought to these ideas through the latest wave of robotics. So we see a lot about, you know, talk about swarms in the drone sphere and so forth. The ability to adapt to gracefully to the graceful degradation of the information environment in the context of potential great power war and so forth. So, you know, this periodization, I think there's two ways of looking at it. One is, you know, the eye of a kind of historian, which is to say, can we discern in these kind of broad brushes, these periods in which successive ideas came into prominence. But I think there's also, you know, a heuristic value, because, you know, I think most historians kind of bristle at that kind of very broad brush periodization. And obviously it's a lot more complicated than these categories allow for. But the argument I would make, for the heuristics of it is that I think that it offers an effective way of thinking about certain kind of problems that are prevalent and prominent throughout this entire and perennial, I would say, throughout this entire period, which is to say the problems that militaries face with the challenge of control. Now, if a military is effectively trying to exert control over the battlefield, maintain discipline and order in its forces in order to achieve, you know, intent, then it's faced with a number of dilemmas. You know, do you achieve this most effectively by centralizing, by bringing everything under the single command, by trying to predict everything in advance? And this is something that we saw under the clockwork model of war. It's something that we see again under the cybernetic conception of war. Or is it more efficient to actually seek adaptation rather than prediction, to accept that there are unknowables, that there's unpredictability inherent to the activity of war, and therefore that rather than try to control and predict everything in advance, what you need to actually cultivate is resilience, adaptation to the unforeseen, and maybe decentralization might be one of the ways of achieving this, because you introduce more flexibility and adaptability into it. So I think there's been this constant push and pull between centralization and decentralization. The dynamic activity of war in the thermodynamic era was some concession to this. I think today, with the development of networks, of course, decentralization has got a very powerful technological ally, and militaries have been trying to make the most of that in the last 20 or 30 years, notably when they come against organizations such as non-state actors of the variety of Al-Qaeda or ISIS that are extremely decentralized, perhaps more by necessity than choice. Yeah. But that has posed huge problems for Western militaries, where you can't decapitate these organizations because they didn't have a kind of a central command, or at least they're able to regenerate very effectively. And that's attractive to militaries who seek to emulate this, but of course are constrained by the fact that they operate as state militaries, which are inherently hierarchical organizations.
You triggered a bunch of ideas here. So the first thing is the non-state actor comment, and thinking about the mechanistic and thermodynamic eras of conflict. I am a big believer in not believing in centers of gravity. I think that they are a thing of the past, and they fit a certain time in the past, and they don't fit today. And they, you know, your example there on the non-state actor is a perfect example of that. There's no real center of gravity to that thing. And again, we tried for, you know, 20 years in Afghanistan and failed. We tried in Iraq and, you know, arguably Iran won, Operation Iraqi Freedom, depending on how you split things, or going back to the framing thing, how you frame the conflict. And so centers of gravity is this idea, though, that just won't die because it sounds cool. Like, it sounds cool to be like, what's the center of gravity? You know, it makes you sound like you're really smart when you ask that question. And I'm always the first person to say, well, there are no centers of gravity today because of the resilience of the system and the networking of the system. And that's one of the things. The other thing I wanted to comment on is I think this idea today, this network era that we're in, is so intertwined with the idea of systems theory that you can't separate the two. And so if you aren't thinking about systems theory as it relates to how organizations operate and organizations operate within conflict, you're thinking about things incorrectly. And one of the key things, you talk a bit about force design, just tangentially in there, but resilience, I think, is a big part of this. And this is in a network-oriented way of operating that we find today, I think the idea of lighter, smaller forces is actually increasing fragility into a system, whereas a larger, more amorphous system makes it more resilient because it adds more nodes, right? Because the network needs nodes, and the more nodes a network has, the more resilient it's going to be to being attacked. And it also just makes it more redundant so that if it is attacked, it has the ability to continue going. And so those are a couple of the key things. This idea of lighter, smaller is something that is really big right now in the discussions on force design as people think about the future and, you know, the swarms that you mentioned or the, you know, long-range precision fires and new technologies like that, the transparent battlefield, you know, this idea that we need smaller, lighter forces. But I think that that's actually looking at it incorrectly because it induces fragility into the system because of the way that things are networked, because it is a system and systems need nodes to communicate and operate. So.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
That's my comment off of what you said. I think it's really interesting.
Well, I mean, I think I agree with you that the ability, I mean, systems may not have inherently centers of gravity, which I would agree is kind of metaphor that comes to us from the mechanistic era.
Yeah.
It is basically associated with the science of mechanism. That's the whole concept comes from there. But at the same time, systems can also nonetheless enter kind of catastrophic kind of crisis.
Yep.
And it is in fact redundancy to a large extent that allows them to flexibly adapt. So the risk with a kind of scientific mindset, which I think is inherent to the ways in which our contemporary society is organized, is that you think of it in terms of efficiency, cost optimization.
Yeah.
And then if you go down that road, of course, then you're going to go as lean as you possibly can.
Yep.
But that might, it's arguably even a bad decision to do in a kind of business environment where you need some redundancy. But by definition, in war, where there is attrition and is an inherent part of the activity, then it does seem ill-advised to not build in significant redundancy. But of course, you have to make the case for it. You have to spend the money for it. It's not very sexy. But it is, I think, very important.
Yeah, I agree. It's hard to, I think, go to the bill payers and say, hey, you know, this thing we need's got to be real big so that it can take a punch and keep going. And that goes, I think, back to the comment on ORSAs. You know, you got ORSAs working on this and systems analysts, and they're trying to whittle this thing down to what is the most optimal thing that I can put in the field. But war is inherently unoptimizing, right? And so that's I think a good segue for my next question. So the big theme that I found woven throughout your book was this idea of order and disorder and how militaries are always, it's like a closed system in entropy, but, you know, militaries always, regardless of whether they're at home station or whether they're deployed and engaged in a conflict, they're always trending towards disorder. And so, you know, at home station, for instance, a military has to conduct training, recruit personnel, do all these things to make sure that it actually stays a functional operational thing. That's just the on the state, you know, on the home station side of things. And when you're deployed, it's even worse if you're engaged in conflict, because then you have somebody actually trying to accelerate you into disorder so that your system essentially collapses, right? And so this dynamic, this tension between order and disorder, I found absolutely fascinating. I think one of the big key takeaways from your book, and I think as we look at force design and concepts and how we're going to operate, Western militaries are going to operate in the future, this idea of, you know, pushing against disorder and maintaining order while doing everything that they're doing is a big idea that needs to be taken forward with them. And so anyway, I say all that to say, what does order and disorder mean to you as you outlined it in the book?
Well, to begin with, we could say that order is quite simply inherent to social life, right? We as humans, we need, and as social animals, we need regularity and predictability. If you think, look at all societies, pay huge importance to rituals, customs, habit. You know, we need things to be steady, to have some repeatability, some predictability. When they don't, we have what, sociologists describe as anomie, like a loss of references, of norms, and we find that incredibly uncomfortable. So order is necessary for human activity. Ordering is also a profoundly psychological and cognitive activity. We are our pattern-seeking animals. That's what we do, sometimes to excess. We want to see meaning and pattern everywhere, which is why we're prone to, conspiracies and all sorts of things, because we need things to make sense to us.
Yeah.
And it's just hardwired into our brains. And it is inherent to scientific pursuit. The science is basically about finding the patterns, the regularities in nature, so that things are just not stuff happening one after the other, but to discover the fundamental order underneath it. And once you've done that, you can then start predicting things, the movement of the planets, etc., the movement of different bodies in our world, and you can then build systems, technology that exploits that, right? In order to build a reliable engine, you need to be sure that you've captured certain regularities in nature that will always operate in the same way. So we need order to a great degree. And of course, in war, order is essential to the coherence of armed forces, to ensure that orders are executed. And militaries have always privileged discipline, right? The breakdown of discipline, the breakdown of order is generally the prelude to defeat.
Yeah.
And even beyond that, war, if it's to be understood as an instrument of politics, right? If governments set objectives, design strategies, they want war to be some kind of predictive tool or predictable tool or instrument as much as possible.
Yeah.
So order has lots of virtues. But of course, the problem is that too much order can be a bad thing.
Yep.
Too much order means stasis, ultimately, rigidity. No room for creativity and novelty. And to go back to kind of our scientific system theory, it ultimately becomes a closed system. And what systems theory tells us about closed systems is that entropy, that is to say disorder, ineluctably arises. The system will eventually kind of break down if it doesn't have some opening out onto into its wider environment. So it can't be a case of pursuing order and trying to expunge chaos. We need chaos because chaos, at least some dose of chaos, because it gives us the space for creativity and innovation. And that's true for society, for science, and for warfare. You think about it in the scientific context, science has gone through different periods where scientists became convinced that they'd understood everything. But then they realized that, and therefore they had ordered the world fully. But then they realized that actually sometimes in order to acquire a greater understanding or higher complexity in our understanding, some order had to be given up.
Yeah.
So, for instance, in the 19th century, the mathematics of probability were introduced because some phenomena just could not be understood through the deterministic mathematics of the Newtonian physics. You needed probability to understand the behavior of gases where there are billions of particles. In the 20th century, quantum physicists understood that you needed the uncertainty principle, which places profound limits on your ability to understand both the motion and the position of particles. And more recently, chaos and complexity scientists have understood that nonlinear dynamics which impose huge impositions, huge restrictions on our ability to predict things. So, for example, we can't predict the weather beyond, you know, a few weeks, because the underlying mathematics do not allow us to calculate long-term predictions because of the measurement problems. But all these, all look like defeats for science. But in a way, is by allowing these limits to some of our understanding, we then acquire greater understanding. Then we can understand the quantum world. Then we can understand the behavior of nonlinear systems. So there's this dance between order and disorder, in which it's necessary to surrender some amounts of order in order to attain greater understanding, perhaps greater or more sophisticated, more nuanced forms of control as a result of that. And I think this is the same problem that arises in warfare as well, whereby trying to control and order everything is most likely going to be self-defeating. You have to allow for some disorder, some motion, some space of chaos where creativity and adaptation will arise. It's a complex judgment and this call that you have to make in all moment, in all times, but I think it's a key one.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think that that's absolutely fundamental to everything. It's there's, you know, it's almost learning through failure to a degree too. You know, you hope that it's incremental learning through failure, not catastrophic learning through failure. And so it's every time you iterate something, you know, in war in this case, every time you iterate something, because there's always this challenge response dynamic at play too, right? So everybody's trying to overcome the thing that you introduced to beat the thing that they introduced, to beat the thing that you introduced. So there's this dynamic going on the whole time. And so it's always one of those things where it's, you know, this incremental learning from failure, this open system. If you're not an open system, being able to sense what's going on in the environment, you're going to fail even bigger than what you would otherwise.
This is, by the way, a very important point to make, particularly in drawing the analogy between science and war, because there is a fundamental difference. I've been drawing that comparisons, but there is one fundamental difference that we really have to underline, which is, you know, scientists are faced with the complexity of nature. But the so far as we know, nature is not wittingly trying to fool us, right? It doesn't change its behavior from one moment to another. It's not involved in actively trying to undo our understanding. Yeah. We assume that it's basically constant and it doesn't care for us, and we can just eventually improve our understanding of it. But war is a very specific human activity where we fight a conscious adversary, and that conscious adversary is always trying to undo us. So what worked one day will not necessarily work the next day. And of course, the stakes are very high because that enemy is trying to kill us or defeat us. And so it's really important to understand, even though we borrow ideas from science, we borrow ideas from, say, industry or the economic sphere, it's very important in the end to think about the specificity of the military sphere, where you have this adversary, and this adversary has to be understood and respected and interacted with, and not viewed as just an external constraint that we have to optimize against.
A good example of this in practical terms too, and this is the last thing I'll say on this, and then we'll jump into the last couple things here, but I think you really see this dynamic in play throughout the Russo-Ukrainian War, where early on, you know, it was Saint Javelin, right? There was all these anti-tank systems that the Ukrainians had introduced. And then it was the Bayraktar drone, right? So there was that male drone up there floating around zapping Russian units. And then those things, those information operations, especially surrounding those innovations, they slowly died off, and you don't hear about Saint Javelin anymore. You don't hear all the Bayraktar stuff anymore. And there was this arc, you know, this continual challenge response dynamic of learning and preventing disorder, right? Because when all the tanks started getting killed, Russia had to innovate different ways to operate. They had to figure out ways to neutralize the Bayraktar drone, whether through, you know, cyber operations or various means of anti-air kinetic shooting it down. And then that cycle is continued, and it goes both ways too, right? Russia's introduced things too, like meat wave tactics. It may be old school, but, you know, it's something that was introduced in the conflict and is still being used, you know, periodically, that Ukraine has to figure out how to overcome, especially given its limited base of military equipment. And so I think that dynamic to me is just a fascinating one, because there's always this challenge response dynamic, and nobody ever comes out and says, "Hey, I've created the thing that's going to win the war." And I think this is part of the problem you see with a lot of the talk about drones. You know, it's like now the FPV drone is the new Bayraktar, if you will. It's the new thing that's like the game winner. But inevitably, there'll be something that comes out to figure out how to combat that. It may take a little bit of time, but there's this back and forth that always exists. So moving on, I wanted to talk briefly about your article. It was published in 2017 called "The Battlefield is Dead." And this is an interesting topic, because a lot of discussions today are talking about the transparent battlefield and how sensors and drones and long-range fires and hypersonics are going to basically make it to where the battlefield will be always open to be seen, and always, because you can be seen anywhere on the battlefield, you're always prone to be targeted. You know, when we factor in the things that I mentioned, all the long-range fires, the drones, all that stuff. And so when I read that article, I was like, oh man, this is terrific. I didn't agree with it, because I don't think that that's the case, but I think that the article was terrific because it got me thinking deeper about this. So in the article, what did you mean by "the battlefield is dead"? Is technology killing the idea of the battlefield? And is that something, if it is that something that we should celebrate, or does it make conflict even more bloody and destructive?
So the article you're referring to is a short piece that I published in this online journal called Aeon. And I should say at the outset that this is a case of the editor writing the title and not myself. So I say this because I think the formula, "the battlefield is dead," is a more definitive and categorical statement than the one I would use. And I would privilege the term of a disappearance of the battlefield. And so the nuance I would introduce here is this idea of the disappearance, right? So it's perhaps not so much that the battlefield is gone per se, but that its appearance is less obvious to us now, that its presence is much more ambiguous today. So that being said, these reflections kind of came out of my second book, The Eye of War, which is really about military perception and military targeting, and thinking about some of the implications of the work I did there. And so it approaches the question of the battlefield in a dual way. So I think the battlefield is both, in this sense, a physical space. Yeah. Okay, that's the kind of immediate kind of conception, but it is also an ideational space. It's a concept, it's an idea, and both, I think, are very important. So, you know, if we think about how the battlefield inhabits kind of the popular imaginary, I think we still think really of the battlefield in a kind of Napoleonic mode. You know, if you think about how battles are played out in, you know, our popular entertainment, like whether it's the Avengers or the Lord of the Rings or whatever it is, we have these big set pieces that are presented to us as decisive outcomes that are the kind of microcosm of war. You know, war is this culmination of the battlefield with some outcomes, a victory and so on. And my argument would be, you know, this idea of the battlefield as a decisive place of combat where troops meet, as something that stands more generally for the temporal and spatial delineation of war, the idea that war is something that happens over a period of time, but it's bookended by a beginning and an end, and also happens in a defined space, the battle, the field.
Yep.
All of that has become, in fact, in reality, much more ambiguous than our imaginary still holds on to. And with that, we also find that it presents challenges to the normative bounding of war, because we've produced kind of political orders where we create spaces and times of war where you can do certain things that you can't do in peacetime, right?
Yeah.
Where killing is authorized, even mandated, where different kinds of laws apply than they would do in the domestic sphere or in the time of peace.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, while this kind of classical imaginary of the battlefield prevails. In fact, ever since kind of the Napoleonic period, this idea, this reality of the battlefield has been continuously reshaped by two centuries of technological and social transformation.
Yeah.
So I think these come manifest in kind of two phenomena. One is the increasing range of targeting. So the fact that over time, our weapons mean that increasingly we can target ever more remote entities, so that you don't no longer need to kind of close on the enemy. You can at this point target any entity that you can locate on the globe, for instance. And then it's also tied to the totalization of war, where war increasingly becomes an activity that engages perhaps all of society. I mean, that's certainly the case in the First and the Second World War, or at least blurs increasingly the boundaries between the civilian and the military. You know, from the Cold War onwards onto the War on Terror, it's increasingly difficult to delineate what constitutes a military entity and what constitutes a civilian entity. You can see this in the way in which technology transfers. And now, you know, the military depends very much on civilian technology. It doesn't lead the technology as it may have done in some areas previously. And even the cultures of military institutions now, are, in many regards, are quite indistinguishable from civilian culture. So all of this, I think, leads to an erosion of the concept of war as a temporal and spatially bounded entity. And the battlefield, the concept of the battlefield kind of evolves alongside it. So people are now, in the War on Terror, there was talk about the global battlefield, right? The battlefield could be anywhere. But when you start saying the global battlefield, it's really tantamount to saying that there's no battlefield, right? Because there's no, you're no longer able to draw those distinctions. Or the battlefield is wherever you say it is, which opens up visions of the battlefield as being something that just kind of opens up punctually. Oh, there's a drone strike in Afghanistan, or, you know, a special forces operation in sub-Saharan Africa. And that's mandated by being an extension of the War on Terror or whatever other campaign it may be.
Yeah.
And so the spatial temporality, along with the battlefield, becomes much more mobile and much more ambiguous. So I think that raises lots of issues in terms of how to conceptualize the activity of war, and what, when does war beginning and when does war end? As for whether that's a better or worse thing, that's quite hard to say. You know, on the plus side, war has become less destructive when we compare it to, of course, the episodes of total war the first half of the 20th century, although, you know, nuclear weapons haven't gone away, and so we still live with the specter of catastrophic conflict.
Yeah.
But admitting that much, one of the big challenges that we face is the question of the normative regulation of war and violence, right? Because the whole apparatus of the laws of war that says, you know, how you should treat enemy civilians and how you should support, how you should treat prisoners of war, all these things become much more complicated when you lose the framing and the legal bounding of this is a declaration of war, this is a space of war, these are the rules that apply, this is domestic, this is a domestic or time of peace, or there's no situation of war, therefore other rules apply. And we saw the difficulties that were raised by, you know, the drone strikes in during the War on Terror. It opened up a kind of normative legal no man's land where it's unclear, you know, what is the status of these strikes? You know, for a while they were conducted by the CIA, and then it came under the Pentagon's authority. Big questions about the legitimacy of these strikes. Big questions of how you then draw the lines, right? And this, I think, is becoming also potentially an issue as great power conflict comes back into fore. Like we're not quite sure what the rules of the game are here. So it's not so much that we will not necessarily see battles and battlefields. I mean, clearly we are seeing some of them in Ukraine right now, but that we still are kind of attached to ideas of the battlefield that in many ways are long gone. And we're still trying to come to terms with the morphology, the phenomenology of war in the contemporary period.
Yeah, one of the things that I think, going back to your comment on like this gray area where we don't understand exactly what the future holds as it relates to this, is, you know, some of this, we now have the capability to, you know, shoot across the globe and hit, you know, state X's industrial base, right? And so it's one of those questions now where if we try and increase dispersion, right? Not dispersion, but distribution, right? We're distributed all over the globe so that we are theoretically more resilient. And we're protecting things like supply bases and supply nodes, right? But like those are operating out of your home country, you know, does that then make, you know, that site in your home country a legitimate target for state X that can hit you across the globe with long range fires? And thus, you know, you thought you were actually insulating your military force from, you know, the loss of supplies, destruction on the battlefield, et cetera, you know, all these different things. But what you've actually done is made your society more susceptible to conflict because you thought that, you know, you thought the rules of the game were we weren't going to shoot each other in our own states. But, you know, Country X said, I don't ascribe to those rules, so I'm going to go ahead and shoot, you know. And that's one of the things that I think we haven't necessarily come to grips with as we think about this idea of, you know, battlefield transparency and distributed and dispersed methods of operating strategically, right, that I think are still out there that have to be – I don't know that we'll come to grips with them until we have to come to grips with them, right? This will be an idea that's continually punted until it's not. My last question for you, because I know we're going a little long here. So is it, and this is just kind of a wrap up, like what have we missed? As a scholar of armed conflict, do you feel there's anything missing from the dialogue on armed conflict or within the professional discourse on the subject?
Well, I guess my response to that would be somewhat related to the previous question, which is that, and it's a kind of broad kind of conceptual point. We, you know, as a community of scholars, as a community of professionals, talk a lot about, I have been talking a lot about the transformation of war, right? Mm-hmm. Constantly thinking about how war is changing and, you know, the latest kinds of innovations and so forth. But all this discussion still seems to be articulated around certain kinds of antiquated notions of war as a referent. So again, kind of we still think about war in kind of the mold of maybe Napoleonic warfare, yeah. Dominated by this kind of state centrism, dominated by the central place of the battlefield, and that's evidenced by the fact that, you know, when we talk about the transformation of war, we're always talking about it in the negative, which by which I mean in the ways in which it's changed from this idea of a reference. Oh, it's not like it used to be.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a reflection of, you know, maybe a bit of a longing for, you know, the certainties or what we perceive as having been the certainties of the past. We see this in, you know, this insistence on this kind of supposed Clausewitzian mantra that the war has a changing character, but an immutable nature. So yes, yeah. Things change, but in the end, we know what war really is. And, you know, I kind of have a provocation here, which is to say, you know, maybe we should forego this idea that there's an essence of war. Maybe what happens if we start to conceptualize war as something that's in permanent becoming, that is being continuously reshaped, that doesn't have this core essence that we attribute to it. Hmm. Maybe we can't say much about war in certain terms other than as an emergent interaction, as a process of intense contestation, as a field of forces. Because when we go back to, you know, through the history of war, when we look at the discussions about it, actually this sense that war is in crisis or that our understanding of war in crisis is almost permanent. I mean, if you go back to the Napoleonic period, Clausewitz himself was thinking, what just happened here in the Napoleonic Wars? This wasn't how war used to be.
Right.
I think every generation is being saying this isn't how war used to be.
Yeah.
And yet we still, I think, are very tied to a certain idea of if not the good old days of war, at least the days where we knew what it is, and somehow we still think that's what it is. And I understand why, of course, it's comforting to have some solid ground that we can fall back on. But I think that so long as we do this, we are constantly talking about the changes of war in those terms as being a departure from this past. But this past has it was never necessarily a referent. It was already a kind of war was already in transformation and in motion back then. And so, you know, my question or my kind of provocation to the field is to say, you know, what happens when we start letting go of these assumptions and start thinking about war as something that is much more impermanable or much more impermanent and much more mutable than we want to think it is.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.